You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
It's the first time that Apple have actually decided to tell people about something that they're developing.
High-speed broadband. Let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
The three main spamming countries are the United States, China, and South Korea.
And I've got some residual powers.
Sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
Senator Coonan, the voice of reason.
There's a couple of systems on a gantry that's actually based on a military missile tracking system.
You put the date on ePray, and you get a whole service just on it.
How does it go?
IE7, you were having trouble installing it because you had a genuine copy of Windows that wouldn't validate properly. What did you have to do to get past that?
Built a new machine.
But how hard can it be?
Well, it's not hard at all.
At the end of the day, the photography is all about the person's eye and what they see.
If you find something that's inappropriate about your child, you need to do something about it because it will not go away.
On air, on the internet, and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the summer series of Tech Talk Radio. I'm Andrew McComb. While we all take a well-earned break over the holiday period, we're going to revisit some of the more memorable programs from the past few years in the lead-up to our return in February 2008. As I mentioned last week, one of the great things about Tech Talk Radio is meeting and talking to people who are leaders in their fields. Tonight's show is no different. We hear from two guests who know everything there is to know about the world's biggest search engines. Adam Lasnik heads up search for Google and has the enviable title of Search Engine Evangelist. And if that isn't enough, Hugh Williams from Microsoft tells us about image search on Microsoft Live. For those of you who don't know, Hugh is an Australian, born and bred and educated in Melbourne. He now lives and works at Microsoft's home base at Redmond in the United States. So whichever is your favourite search engine, stick with us for the inside knowledge on what makes these search engines tick. We'll also hear from Adam Turner, and Dr. Ron tells us about the rise of copper theft in Australia. So stay tuned to Tech Talk Radio as we join Hugh Williams, Development Manager at Microsoft's Live Search.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hugh, you were a student at RMIT in the early 80s, which coincidentally was the same time that I was there. So how does a Melbourne boy find himself living and working for the world's largest software company some 25 years later?
That's a long story, Andrew. So I was actually there in the late 80s at RMIT, so you're making me a little older than I really am. But I was there from 88 to 90, and then after that, I ventured out into the software world. I started up my own consultancy, actually, and did a lot of consulting to Telstra, a few other places. And I guess around 1993 or so, I found what I was doing wasn't really engaging, and so I went back to RMIT, met up with a guy there who was interested in searching DNA and protein databases, which was an interesting problem.
And you hang out with all the good guys, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. And so I decided to do a PhD with this guy, and spent about 3 years doing that. Finished that in 96, 97, somewhere around there. And despite the best intentions, at the time my intentions were to go back and do something in the software industry. I actually stuck around at RMIT. So I took a job as a lecturer there. I ended up being a senior lecturer there. Finally got to being an associate professor there. And all through that period, learned lots of teaching, lots of research, and my research work sort of moved into the search area. So I was researching aspects of web search, things like crawling, searching documents, interfaces for searching, all those kinds of things, all sorts of things that were being done at the time by big search companies, some of those giants that you probably remember from the 90s, like Alta Vista and Excite and Lycos and those kinds of guys. So I've kind of been into search pretty early in the web, really. And at some point, I guess I got sick of publishing papers, and I wanted to be doing something a little bit more impactful. And it was somewhat of a coincidence that Microsoft was getting into the search space. So I spoke to some people that I knew there. I was pretty well connected in the search world at the time, and really found that the team could paint a really believable story for me. There was this little startup group in Microsoft, and it was full of you know, very ambitious, very driven people.
Was this here in Australia or was this in the US?
This was in the US, yeah. There's actually a couple of Australians working there who I knew pretty well, and ended up going over there and talking to the team, spent a few days there, had an interview, all the kinds of standard things you do, and just really hit it off with the guys. I sort of thought it was a fantastic environment, small team, sort of startup culture, but, you know, obviously backed by, you know, the enormous backing of Microsoft. So I decided to leave Australia, took the family and moved up to Seattle and been there ever since.
All right. Your business card states that you're a principal developer for Live Search. What does the job description entail for that?
Well, that's a good question. So it's a bit of research, a bit of development. I think it's one of those jobs that sits pretty much down the middle. What I'm really involved in is trying to conceive ways to meet users' information needs. So, you know, we know out there that users of the web are frustrated by search. You know, only around 50% of the users who use search engines get an answer to their information need. So my job is to try and bridge the gap between that 50% that are getting what they want and the 100% that we'd love to give everybody. So really, my job is to sit around and you know, look at opportunities to improve search. I work across the multimedia space. I work across news search. I work across instant answers. And I'm lucky enough to also work on the core of the web searching algorithm. I do a lot of work with Microsoft Research as well. So I put my research training, I guess, into practice as well, trying to sort of bring people together across the company to work on search.
So tell me about your team. How many people work in the search team, and what's the job diversity like?
It's a moderate sized team. Not incredibly large. I think it's still got that really good startup feel about it. But the diversity is really there. We've got people with backgrounds like mine, so track record in research, lots of publications. We've moved into a development organisation and want to ship software. We've got lots of people who are sort of fresh out of PhDs in the team. We've got guys who've got double degrees in perhaps engineering and computer science. Lots of straight computer science graduates, and there's even a guy on my team actually who's got a history degree, and he's just a fabulous computer scientist. So a real mix of people, very diverse backgrounds. It's a very multicultural team. Lots of guys from China, from India, from Australia, all over the world.
The online world is evolving at breakneck speed, with bandwidth becoming cheaper, faster, and the use of rich media on the web, such as high-res images, audio such as podcasts, and the plethora of video pop-ups that are starting to hit the site, such as YouTube. The next generation of search engine must certainly have its job cut out for it. How's the search engine evolved over the past decade or so and into the selective and highly skilled beast that it certainly has become today?
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there's been a lot of evolution in the search space. I mean, I think if you wind the clock back 7 or 8 or 9 years, I think, search to most people really simply meant, typing in a query and getting back 10 blue links. And there was not much more to it than that. There was blue links and some advertising. If you look at what we've got now, it's a very rich environment. We've got tools like video search, and video now, as I'm sure you're really alluding to, is something that consumers, users out there, not only consume but also create. This is a huge emerging, exponentially growing area. So video search has become important. With the advent of the digital camera and the fact that just about everybody has one now, there's an enormous amount of image data being created and put up on the web through photo sharing sites. So searching over those is incredibly important. So we're seeing things like video search, we're seeing things like image search, we're seeing very integrated news search experiences that bring together clusters of articles that are published around the world and mix those with multimedia. We're seeing even on the core web tab, some significant evolution. We see things like instant answers, as an incredible part of what we do. One of our goals is very much to reduce the time from when a user queries to when they get their answer. And instant answers are a way where we can actually take answers and put those front and center at the top of the web tab. So we do things like give people stock prices or share prices. We tell you what the weather is. We answer using facts from Encarta, so you can ask questions like, what's the population of China? And we can give you an authoritative fact at the top of the screen. We can give you sneak previews of images and videos, you know, teasers before you go into the vertical and fully immerse yourself in the experience. And recently, I guess it must be about 8 or 9 months ago, we shipped a related searches feature in our web search. So when you type a query, we can actually suggest other queries that you might want to try. And that's a fantastic tool, you know, if you're trying to do research. You know, you're in there and you're looking for a digital camera, we can actually start to suggest companies, model names, all those kinds of things. So you can really lead you through a querying experience that hopefully, you know, reduces the time from when you pose the query to when you get the answer. So it's certainly very, very evolving. I think we're seeing a lot more integration across these different media types, and we're being a lot more imaginative about how to solve problems. But still a long way to go. You know, it's a very, very fast-moving space, as you pointed out.
Let's talk a little bit about, I guess, searching for images a bit. How many images are actually indexed these days? Like, there must be billions of them on the internet, and what are the most popular ones?
Yeah, well, most definitely there's billions out there. You know, the image space is massive, and if you go and count things like all those little page decorations, you count all those little balls and lines and, you know, Amazon logos and things that are out there, you know, there's billions and billions and billions of images. And certainly our goal is to collect all of those and put those in a central place where you can find them. It's a massive growing space. When we built the site, I mean, we really sat down and did some really deep digging in the data to try and figure out what our users really wanted. And I think you know, when you use live search images, you'll see that we have a profoundly different user experience. It doesn't hit you right over the head. It's one of those things you sort of learn to use and immerse yourself in, but it's a profoundly different experience. One of the things I think that's really key in the difference in our engine is that we've removed the paging behavior that you're probably used to in search.
Yeah, so, it's one of the things I like about it, actually. You can actually just scroll down and not have to go next, next, next.
Yeah, and that was a direct response to what we found in the data.
All right, let's talk a little bit about what's under the hood. Nodules are the key to indexing an image. What's a nodule and why are they so important?
Ah, now you're getting into the technical stuff. So
yeah.
This is one of those things where I start waving my arms around and trying to explain things. So I'll try and do my best my best over the phone to explain the idea. But basically, you know, when you're searching for an image on the web, you're not really searching the image itself. What you're doing is you're typing in a query that's text. So you're typing something like Britney Spears, and what you're asking us to do is to find images that are in the context of the text Britney Spears. So really, you know, what you probably want as a result are images that occur on pages that contain the text Britney Spears. And so we have to have a way of representing that internally within our search engine. We have to have a way of, you know, expressing what text is associated with an image. So we call that a nodule. So we basically go and process web pages, and we extract meaningful text that we're sure is associated with an image, and we annotate that image with that text. And that little document, that little thing that describes that image, we call it a nodule. So our collection of images that you can search is, you know, billions of images, and each one of those images we call a nodule.
All right, now let's talk about indexing pages for a sec. Is the spider the image used different to the spider that the main search engines use? Like, have you written your own custom bot to actually go and find pictures?
Yeah, that's right. So we have a media crawler that goes out and fetches media, and that's distinct from our web crawler that goes out and fetches web pages. The reason for that is that they're architecturally quite different. It turns out that the steps you need to go and fetch a page and then go and fetch all the images and create these nodules, it's quite a different process architecturally to just going out and fetching web pages. So the web guys have kind of got it easy. Their crawler just fetches pages. It ignores images. We've got the tough problem. We've got to not only go and get the page and process it, but we've got to then go and get the images, the video, audio files, those kinds of things, and bring those back as well. The other thing that's really different about multimedia is these are much larger files. So pulling down a web page, you know, it's fairly trivial. Pulling down a huge image or a large video consumes much more bandwidth. You have to be much, much more careful about, you know, what you pull down, because you want to spend that bandwidth as wisely as you can to build the best possible, freshest collection. And so there's, you know, there's architecturally a whole bunch of tricks that are different in multimedia. So we basically separate out the crawling processes based on the same technology, but, you know, architecturally, you know, the result is quite a lot different.
And you probably have the bigger hard drives because you've got more images and more information to store, I'd suspect.
That's too, it. Yeah, our hard drives are definitely full. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Does Image Spider respect the laws of traditional indexing processes, such as links on web pages and other robots.txt files and the likes?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, all of our crawlers follow the robot.txt standard.
Stay with us on Tech Talk Radio. There'll be more of this fascinating interview with Microsoft's Hugh Williams after the break.
You're listening.
Dr. Ron?
Here I am listening.
Residual powers.
And I've got some residual powers.
You can't turn off CDMA.
In terms of the volume,
I understand to give fingerprints. Now,
we may have digressed.
Talk radio.
Bill Burgess also claimed the country would remain behind.
We used to think 600 kilometers.
Don't open things that are good that you're not expecting, even if they do a thing.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you.
Subscribing to the Tech Talk Radio podcast is so easy. It's child's play.
Podcasting's so easy, even my little brother can do it.
Step one, visit the iTunes Music Store and search for Tech Talk Radio in the podcast section. Step two, click subscribe and you're done. Now every week you'll be able to listen to Tech Talk Radio whenever, wherever and however you like. You could be mowing the lawn, on a train, in a car, on a plane, at work,
Podcast
visiting the relatives,
Chad,
washing the
Charlie
car.
Chrissy.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We're going to continue our interview now with Hugh Williams from Microsoft, the man behind Microsoft's image search on the new live.com website. Adult images, obviously problematic because we all like a safe environment online these days. What precautions are taken to ensure the safe online experiences for the youngsters?
Well, you know, we do everything we possibly can to provide a safe searching environment. It's a super hard challenge for us, you know, we've used every technique that that we can come up with to enable that, and we just double down every month and try and improve those techniques, add more techniques, and build a safe environment. But the kinds of things we need to do to provide those kinds of, you know, to provide a really safe environment are many and varied. So, for example, I'll you know, illustrate a little. You know, if you set up a web page and you start running adult advertisements on that page, then we can probably infer that you're an adult site. So, from a web perspective, if you're linking in advertisements from an adult advertiser, then you know, we can almost assume that you're an adult site. Another thing that we do is we do some image processing. So we do things. Now, we pull down an image, we do some face detection, we try and determine if the image contains a face. If it does, then we'll do some skin detection, we'll try and look for skin within that image, and then we'll try and classify that skin as being adult or non-adult. So we're doing all sorts of different things. They're just two of the techniques that we use, but you know, we're carrying out a multi-step process on every page and every image that we pull down to try and best determine whether it's a safe page or whether it has adult content. So really, really hard problem, and we throw every tool that we know of at it, and we're just doubling down every month trying to improve those techniques.
But what's your success rate like? Have you found that you're getting most of them, or a couple slip through, or what?
Look, I think it's impossible to provide an entirely safe environment, and that's a challenge that, you know, that's just a fact right across the industry. There is no such thing as an entirely safe web search engine. But I'm really pleased with the progress we've made, and I can absolutely confidently say that we have a highly competitive engine out there, that our techniques are as safe as anybody else's.
All right, now I'm keeping in theme with Britney Spears at the moment. Duplicates. There must be tens of thousands of Britney Spears lookalikes and likewise. How do you actually prevent a system like that from indexing every or presenting to the user every image of Britney Spears that there is online? Because there'd be plenty.
Yeah, that's a super hard problem, Andrew. It's a really, really tough one. What we do at the moment is we remove exact duplicates. And what I mean by that is we take the image and we push it through a mathematical function, and out the end comes a little signature. And if two images have exactly the same signature, then we know that it's the same file, hosted in two different places. You know, it's got the same dimensions, the same image type, you know, it's exactly the same image. And in that case, we'll only show the highest ranked duplicate. So if there's, you know, if an image is, syndicated around the web, and it's exactly the same, then you'll only see one of them. Near duplicates, however, that's a tough problem. So, you know, if you run a query on any major search engine, and on an image search engine that's a movie poster or an album cover, you're going to see duplicates. You're going to see lots of movie posters that are cropped slightly differently, maybe rotated slightly differently. You know, maybe somebody's added a little bit of text. Maybe one of the posters is in English and the other one's in Spanish. You're going to see them in different file formats, or all those kinds of problems. And it's a super, super, super hard problem to go and address that properly. It's one we're actually working on right now. It's one we hope to do a great job of, but frankly, it's a shortcoming of all image search engines right now, and it's one that I'm sure is infuriating to our users who are trying to nail those kinds of scenarios. So right now, you'll get lots of pictures scroll down far enough that are, you know, pretty near duplicates of Britney Spears, but hopefully our ranking process, you know, at least in those first few pages, and I use that with inverted commas because we have the smart scroll feature, you'll see a fair bit of diversity.
All right, and because there would be so many, images of Britney delivered to your desktop, are there any ways of filtering for them? Like, say, for example, you wanted black and white Britneys or large screen. Obviously, you've got the ability to search through the drop-down, I think, which is the top right-hand corner of the image search page. But let's say I want black and white. Can I look for black and white ones?
Yeah, we just shipped a feature that does that, Andrew. We shipped it about a month ago. So the trick is basically you need to add filter:BW. So it's filter:BW. It's a sort of one word, no spaces, and you'll just get black and white images. And we've got a couple other little tricks as well you might want to try. One is we've got filter:face, and that'll show you only images of Britney's face, and filter:portrait, which will show you sort of waist up shots. So sort of more your kind of classic, camera shot that you'd take of the family. So there's little sneaky little tricks in there, some advanced operators. Again, you know, I was talking before about how I'd love to expose some of the dimension features in a cool, interesting way. I want to expose these features in a much more usable, cool, interesting, accessible way to the majority of our users. I don't expect people in the long term to have to remember to type filter:BW. I think we need a better way of exposing that, but it's something we're working on right now.
Do you have a blog or something where people can chip in with their 2 cents worth or find out what's new in image search?
Yeah, we do. We have the live search blog. So if you jump on live.com or 9msn.com.au and type live search blog as your query, then the first result you'll get back is the live search blog, and you can click on that. And there's pretty regular postings of goings on around the team.
Let's talk about video and audio. What's the future here? What are we going to be seeing in respect to podcast audio and videos on all the million and one, you know, these great Facebook, YouTube things that are popping up around the place?
So what I can tell you is that I'm pretty excited about and working on video search right now. It'll be one of those things where I just have to say stay tuned to this space. You can expect to see something happening from my team pretty soon in the video space.
Just for listeners' point of view, the only thing I can think of would be you would collect video information, or you'd find a video clip, you'd do a speech-to-text recognition and then make that searchable. Is that sort of along the lines of what we're going to be seeing in the future of search, regardless of who provides it in the foreseeable?
Yeah, I mean, I you're absolutely right. I mean, I think with video, there's essentially two different kinds of search that are possible. You know, one is something that's very analogous to what we talked about with image search. You know, you basically take textual clues from web pages and use those as the tools to allow you to search. And then the other way you can go at the problem is, as you point out, is to actually dive within the video itself and do things like closed caption decoding. So, you know, we were all used to pressing the closed caption button and seeing closed captions. You can decode those and index that text and make that searchable. Or as you point out, you know, you can do speech to text on the audio and actually produce your own text from broadcasts that might not contain closed caption data, and that allows you to actually search within the video. So not only can you just find a video as sort of a one big element that matches some text on a web page, but you can actually get within the video and show people the relevant parts of the video. There's certainly interest in both of those. I think a great video search engine would absolutely need to do both. But right now, the very vast majority of products that are out there only do the first scenario. I haven't really seen anybody make great steps into the second. Speech to text, pretty hard. It's possible to train up a speech to text model so that it'll work really well for one type of a video. So, for example, you know, we could train up a model that would work fantastically well for your podcast, but it might not work so well for, you know, a football podcast or a soccer podcast or a podcast that has a native speaker from America. So it's one of those fickle little areas where you've got to get the system just right for each kind of environment. It's very hard to build a robust speech-to-text engine that can handle all the variety of audio and video data that you find out on the web. So it's a hard problem, but it's one that, you know, obviously you can tell from my excitement about it that, you know, I'm really, really interested in. Microsoft Research Asia's made enormous progress in that area. They've been doing some great work in that area for 5 to 10 years. There's a speech server group up in Redmond who've been working hard on this problem, and you might have heard that Microsoft recently acquired Tell Me Networks, who've done a lot of work in this area. So it's certainly a hot area within Microsoft, but getting it to be robust enough so it works right across all that heterogeneous content that's out on the web is a really, really hard problem.
Finally, the crystal ball, Hugh. 10 years ago, we remember way back then what the net was like. It's nothing like what it is today. 10 years' time, what do you think search is going to be like? We're obviously going to have a lot of interesting new tools. Where do you think we'll be down the track?
That's a good question. I look back over the last 10 years, and I can remember a couple of big breakthroughs. You know, one of the things I think that excited me, back in the late 90s, this is long before I was involved in the search industry myself, was when search engines moved from just showing you the first 200 characters of each document to actually providing you little snippets that showed you where the words you were querying, where the words you typed in your query actually occurred within the document. And we're all very used to that now. Those little snippets really, really describe, you know, what's in the document. So I remember that as being one of those sort of breakthroughs. And, you know, it doesn't seem like a wow moment. You know, I think, it just seems like a simple technology, but I think that was something that really lifted search from, something that was difficult to use. You had to kind of go and inspect pages and go, oh, no, back. You know, you had to sort of this frustrating mode you're in into something where you could really look at that results page and get a really good idea which results were likely to be good for your query. So I think, you know, that was one of those little breakthrough moments. And, you know, we have them every now and then. But I guess, you know, looking forward into the future, some of the things that will change will be simple things like that. You know, somebody will have a really great intuition and just adjust something slightly, and we'll all just sigh with relief that this blindingly obvious thing's been done. And then, of course, you know, there's just going to be, more constant reinvestment and innovation in the areas you'd expect. You know, I'm very excited about multimedia search. You know, I think video is now so prevalent and so easy to produce on your cell phone or with your cheap camcorder that's going to be an enormously popular space. Image search is obviously, you know, continuing to grow. We're all putting our digital photos up online and sharing those, so that's going to be an area where there's, you know, continued investment and growth. Audio, as you pointed out, is a huge area. I'd love to see some really great technology in the music search space. I'd love to be able to say, hey, this is an audio file that I really like. You know, I'm enjoying this. You know, what other things are like that, and actually be able to find things that are, you know, similar in beat and style and length, and, you know, start to sort of explore a music space and get recommendations. Personalization is another big area, I think, where we need to make some gains. You know, somebody sent me a query today where they said, this is from Redmond, somebody said, I was searching for Typhoon, and it's a well-known Thai restaurant up in Redmond, and what I got was a news article about a typhoon in China. You guys need to fix this. And, you know, my first reaction was, wow, we're doing a great job with our news instant answer. That's fantastic. But, you know, clearly that wasn't what that particular user wanted. So, you know, being more personal, being more local, being more about, you know, the context you're in. Are you at home? Are you at work? Is it nighttime? Is it daytime? And getting a little bit more sensitive about those kinds of aspects, and then sort of moving towards really personalizing the experience for you is something that's going to be important. And the last one I guess I'm really excited about is this whole social aspect. You know, we're all out there sharing and tagging and uploading and downloading and, you know, storing things, you know, trying to share them with friends, joining communities, those kinds of things. And I think bringing all those aspects of your sort of network and your behaviors into search is a really, really exciting space. So I think it'll become more personal. I think it'll become more multimedia. And I think there'll just be these really sensible little breakthroughs that you know, we'll just take for granted and sigh with relief when they happen. And they're the ones that I love the most. You know, I think that's what really got me excited about image search when we were working on it. I mean, we just had a couple of really simplifying, sensible things like the smart scroll feature sort of come to us when we were looking at the data. You know, there's sort of things that seem obvious in hindsight. So I'm waiting for those to sort of pop out as well. I hope to be part of a few more of those.
Hugh, I don't think redundancy is something that you and your team have to ever worry about. So thank you very much for your time this evening on Tech Talk Radio. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've learned a lot, and hopefully we can do it again when you're in town soon.
Thank you, Andrew. It was great fun.
You're listening.
Dr. Ron?
Here I am listening.
Residual powers. And I've got some residual powers.
You can't turn off CDMA.
In terms of the volume,
over a standard fingerprints. Now, this
we may have digressed.
Talk radio.
Bill Burgess also claimed the country would remain behind.
We used to think 600
don't open things that are as good that you're not expecting, even if they do a thing.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the summer series of Tech Talk Radio. Adam Turner's a regular here on the Tech Talk Radio panel. As a journalist, he's a writer for the Melbourne Green Guide and the Melbourne Age, not to mention a few other publications and online services. Every week, Adam has a view on technology, and we call it a view from the couch. Adam Turner's View from the Couch on Tech Talk Radio.
Google has unleashed a killer Android, and it would seem resistance is futile. Android is Google's new Linux-based operating system for mobile phones, to rival Symbian, Windows Mobile, and of course OS X thanks to the iPhone. A few years ago I would have added Palm OS to that list, but not anymore. There's been talk of a Google phone for a long time. The aim, of course, is to put advertising on the smaller screen, which one assumes would subsidize the cost of the phone and your calls. It will also naturally play nicely with Google's growing stable of location-based services such as Google Maps. The big question is the so-called Google phone still to come, or will Android just assimilate existing hardware manufacturers? Rather than release the definitive Google phone like the iPhone, I'd say Google is more likely to license its OS to manufacturers such as HTC, which makes the iMate and Dopod range of smartphones. HTC has already announced it will release a device running Android in the European market next year. Until now, HTC devices have generally run the clunky Windows Mobile operating system, so Android is yet more bad news for Microsoft. Google will also be quick to release a software developer's kit and will certainly be much easier to deal with than Apple and the iPhone. Apple insists on controlling everything, the hardware, the software, so it refuses to license its operating system to other manufacturers and is very difficult to deal with when you're writing software for their platform. While this improves system stability, it also ensures that Apple remains a niche player. Google knows that hardware is irrelevant. Google also knows the operating system is irrelevant, and even the software is really irrelevant. It's all just a means to an end. Content and services are what it's all about. Android and the concept of the Google phone are just a platform that make it easy for people to consume Google services whilst looking at ads. Nothing else matters. The network is also becoming irrelevant, much to the dismay of telcos such as Telstra, who want to own the customer. As telecommunications becomes commoditized, Telstra doesn't want to just shift ones and zeros, it wants to offer services and content as well. As such, I'd expect to see Android phones available on the Hutchison 3 network before Telstra's next G. As for the iPhone, it might have slick graphics and a touchy-feely interface, But if Android tightly integrates Google services into a mobile device, then it will lay waste to the competition. Steve Jobs may have carried the iPhone down from the Mount Moses style, but I'd say an army that marches behind Android is invincible.
Entertaining, informative, and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Continuing on from search engines, which we've been discussing over the last week, Lid joins us from Palo Alto. And what have you discovered about search engines? You said something about title descriptions and page descriptions, Lid.
I did. I actually had a look at to understand exactly what they are and how they work, because I wasn't. I'm really quite new to SEO myself, even though, you know, I have been looking at it for some time. But one thing I realised is, you know, when you type a search query into Google, for instance,
yeah,
and you say, I'm looking for red cars in Brighton, whatever it is, and it comes back with the results. Now, these results, they give you the title and the description. But many people, and it astounds me how many people, don't include them. So you know how in Explorer or whatever browser you're running, you have the little title that says, you know, welcome to Tech Talk Radio, informative, innovative, all that sort of stuff? Well, that's what people are not doing. And some people are having the same name for each, like, they've got 20 pages and they use the same title for each page. And then they're going, well, how come Google doesn't recognize me or whatever the search engine is? So I thought I'd just quickly go over that because it's really quite interesting. The first thing I noticed was when I looked at the actual description tags, they seem to use no more than 65 characters, and that's letters and numbers and spaces, everything, when they describe the title. So if you're writing a page and you give it a title that has more than 65 characters, like, let's say, or Tech Talk Radio, whose title is Tech Talk Radio, Entertaining, Informative, Independent, and an Australian Tech Podcast, which is 88 characters, when you search for Tech Talk Radio, Google will return to you Tech Talk Radio, Entertaining, Informative, Independent, dash, and it stops. And that's 66 characters.
So the 66 is really important, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, this is not something that Google has said or anyone has said, but I've been just looking at different sites and it seems to be consistent.
It's a very good tip, actually. I think I'll change it on the Tech Talk Radio site so that it fits that beautiful 66 characters. Do you know how the other search engines handle it, or you've just looked at it on Google?
No, I've looked at it only on Google because I haven't had that much time. But I'm saying if you stay under 65, you're fine. And they'll put in everything. And this is where your keywords are really relevant, because if you put something like, and I'll get to an example in a minute, if you put something very simple, they're not going to know what you are or who you are. Here's another interesting thing. With the description itself, what happens is they will, again, use X amount of characters. Now, what I've looked at, I've probably looked at about 10 sites and I've measured them, and the same number seems to come back, which is don't use more than 160 characters, but make them count, because these are really important when Google's searching how to describe your site.
All right, so let's just summarise it. We're looking at the title of, or the description of your website. Was that 65?
Yep. I was saying, I was counting up to 65 and less. I'm sure I've seen some that go up to 70, but I just, personally, if I was doing it, I'd make sure, you know, 65, there's five characters. It's not that big a deal. I'd make sure that you keep it under 65.
And the description tag was 156. You were saying 150. Is that right?
Yeah. I was saying keep it under 150 and you're certain to get every
and
little bit.
And that'll be nice now, and neat and tidy and look pretty swanky on Google.
It will. So also, the other thing I did, I had a look at a current affair. You know, your show, current affair show on every night. Well, on their homepage, they've used the title, a title that includes 70 characters, but it all comes across and it says, the latest news on Australia's most current affairs. And that's very clean, it's very clear, you know immediately what they mean. However, they don't have a description. So what Google does, for instance, it says, okay, they've got no description on the page, we're going to go to the Open Directory Project, DMOS. So they go there and they say, is it here? And as a matter of fact, ACCA turns up on DMOS. And guess which words come back in the description on Google when you type
bad journalism, atrocious current affairs reporting, over-exaggeration, and the chaser. What?
Now, if Google goes to DMOS, has a look at the page, has nothing there to describe the page, it goes to DMOS. If DMOS has nothing, Then it goes off to your back to your site and says, okay, what can we use from here? And I've got to give you the best example, which is Harvey Norman. They have a homepage that's full of pictures and flash. Okay?
Yeah,
so there's nothing there. Yeah, nothing there for Google to see. So they have in their code, if you view source, you can see that they've got, you know, no title. Actually, they do have a title, which is something like Harvey Norman Home. That's it, Harvey Norman website home. That's it.
And that's very explanatory and descriptive about the page, isn't it? Well, I guess it is the homepage.
I know, but I mean, it's on every page. The only page where it doesn't appear is on the corporate information in terms of who the people are that work there. So what they do, they use lots of flash, they use lots of Java, they use lots of pictures, but there's nothing, and they have keywords. So they've got their little thing that says, these are our keywords, computers, electrical, store, camera, digital, TV, DVD, CD, gift vouchers, hot deals, printers, games, online, PC, flat screen, interest-free, mobile, laptop, notebook. Who's going to type any of that in?
Well, on average these days, you type 3 or 4 words into Google, and that's a keyword. So there's no matches there as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and guess what? I typed all of them in independently, one at a time. Not one comes back. Like, the first 30 listings are not coming back with Harvey Norman. I did this on the Australian website, by the way, Australian Google, and not one of them, the first 30, and nothing to do with Harvey Norman. Now, the interesting thing with their website is that these keywords mean nothing, like I said earlier, because on their page, on the home page, not one mention of these keywords, not one. So Google's going, well, hang on, these keywords that they've got in their HTML don't correspond with the keywords they've got on their front page, so we're basically going to ignore them. And, you know, I'm sure they've built the brand name, but now it's a matter of building, you know, their online branding. And this is where I think web designers, you know, who are making the pretty pictures with the flash and with all the other stuff, and they're making it all very pretty, as well as marketing people who know a lot about marketing but know nothing about technology, and they really need to start learning, because this is a big industry. This is like a huge industry. Anyway, I went on to search for HarveyNorman.com.
As opposed to the .com.au?
Yes.
And what did you find?
You get a page. You should go. I laughed. I literally laughed. You get a page saying, if you're here, you've made a mistake. No links. Nothing. So you've gone to a page that basically tells you there's an error. You're at a place which really doesn't exist.
So there's no domain, HarveyNorman.com?
Well, I went to Who Is and said, who owns HarveyNorman.com? And it's HarveyNorman.com.au. You would think, wouldn't you, that they would say, hey, you've made a mistake, you've gotten to this page, can't they just redirect the page, you know, just bang, surely, you can tell me this, you're a programmer, what can't they just redirect the page immediately back to harveynorman.com.au?
Some organisations are a little bit strange when it comes to that sort of thing, because, as I said before, they just don't think web. You know, there's a lot of, and it's a bit sad, really. That's what we're trying to do business-wise on a professional basis, is educate our customers about the way they should be running their websites. But a lot of large organisations still don't focus on the fact that the web is really probably their biggest selling tool. Let's talk about Dig. What do you know about Dig in the United States?
Well, Dig, and you've heard of the others, I take it, as well.
I'll mention them for our listeners.
Slashdot is the original, 1997 it came out. And then you have Furl, and then you have Newsvine, and then you have Netscape, who's now redesigned their site, and they have a totally different format.
They used to have a browser, didn't they?
They did. And then you've got Delicious, and then you've got Fark, F-A-R-K, by the way, and then you've got StumbleUpon, and you've got Reddit, and you've got Dig, as Dr. Ron mentioned.
So what are these sites? What are they? How would you describe them?
They're called social bookmarking, basically, and it's a collaborative way. They talk about how community members go to these sites, vote on stories or put in stories, and then these sites rise to the top of the list or go to the bottom. And they call it bulksonomy. They call it bulksonomy, which is, you know, I suppose defined as a user-generated taxonomy. And it means that basically you're categorising and retrieving web pages and photographs and links and videos, whatever it is, and you're voting on these things and saying, this one I really like. Now, if someone uses Dig, for instance, and all of these pretty much run the same, you'd really have to have a look at them to see what the differences are. They're pretty much running the same sort of way. I join as a member. There's two things you can do. You can join as a member and get the opportunity to vote or submit content. And that can be your own content, but it can also be, I've read a story that Dr. Ron wrote, and I thought it was really cool, even though I don't know him or the story or anything, I can then say, hey, check out this story if I'm a member of any of these social bookmarking sites. I can actually, you know, say, let's say this guy, Dr. Ron, has written this brilliant story, and I put it up there. Then it goes into this little area where other members get to vote on, is it a good story or is it a crap story? So if it's good, it rises in the ranks, and suddenly it's on the home page. And what's happening as a result of this is people, they're calling it the new influencers. The Wall Street Journal recently, I think in February, did a story about the new influencers, where people that submit, members of Digg and Reddit and Spark and all these other places, if they vote on a story of some content somewhere out on the web and it goes up in viewings, I suppose, they're actually influencing what other people see. So there was a site called Fanst, which I think I briefly mentioned some time ago, and the guy at, could have been Digg, 17-year-old student, he turns around and says, okay, I really love this site, Fanst, and no one's seen it. Why isn't it better known? Next day, bang, 50,000 hits on Fanster. Now, you know, you can imagine how happy they'd be about it. So what's happened with this guy? Like I said, he's a student, 17-year-old student. He now works for Netscape, earns $1,000 a month, which may not sound like a lot to you, but, you know, think back when you were 17 and working part-time, you know, delivering the newspaper, whatever it was you were doing. I was working in the milk bar, and, you know, I got $20 tops. So getting $1,000 a month would be pretty cool.
Oh, exactly.
Student, especially when... So these influencers are doing a really good job. The other thing that I use it for especially is research, because what it does provide is what are the topical subjects, what are people talking about right now and how current are they? Because I'm sure you know, you go into any search engine, you type in some product that you're looking for and it comes back with a whole heap of stuff, and you might actually get five-year-old information that you don't really want and it's not relevant to you right now. These sites, you go to these places, you don't have to be a member. You can search the place and you will be given, you know, the top stories about a particular thing at any given time. So they're great as a starting point for research. They're not great, obviously. You know, you can't just sit there and say absolutely everything here is true, but they're a great starting point. Newsvine is interesting. Newsvine does the same thing. They're also a social bookmarking site, but they have journalists from Associated Press, from New Scientist, from ESPN, that submit content there. So, you know, you're getting a bit of a better quality, I suppose, story.
So the future for these influential sites is looking pretty rosy, isn't it? If, as you say, if you want to weed out the old information that some of the search engines give you, these sites are a great alternative to get information which is current in the last few days or maybe weeks. Is that a fair statement to say?
Yeah, absolutely. It's hours. You know, they will say to you, this was posted, you know, an hour ago, 10 minutes ago. If you go to the right social bookmarking site, you know, like Digg does a lot of technology and science, you know, and Newsvine as well does a lot of technology and science. So depending where you go, you know, you're more than likely to find topical, current, up-to-date information about something that at least gives you a starting point to say, okay, where do I go from now? So that's a really cool thing for researchers in particular.
All right. In just a few moments, we're going to hear from Adam Lasnik in your interview that you did at Google. What was it like walking into Googleplex? That would have been daunting, walking into the front door of the world's largest search engine.
I know. Well, no, it was really good. It's so big. The Googleplex is so big.
What are your first impressions when you walk in the door there? How did
walk
you feel?
Walking the door, walking the gate. Well, when you drive in, you're stopped by a security guard. You can't actually drive in. And there's all sorts of access points. It's not like, you know, you remember Channel 9, you drive in at the front, you get the security guy and you drive through. Google has 20 of these people all over the place, so you can't actually drive onto the premises without going past someone.
Is this common for this sort of, for these type of organisations in this part of the world? Is this, like, does eBay have the same thing and Microsoft have the same thing and all that?
I have got to admit, I haven't been to them, but this is huge. We're talking about streets and streets and streets. I should go down and film it.
That's its own suburb, is it?
Or something. It feels like it. It's a humongous place. It's just streets of Google. It's huge. So once you get past the security guy, which was fine, I said, this is who I'm here to see, building 43. So depending what building you need to go to, they walk you through. But, I mean, just walking through, everyone's just standing around having a chat. You know, there are a couple of dogs out there.
So you get ushered through the place, do you?
No, they don't usher you through. He gets you to park, he tells you where to park, and then he says, this is where you need to go. Bang, left, right, rah, rah, rah. And I did, but the interesting thing was, it's huge, I can't describe it, it's just mammoth. But going through, it's just interesting to see, like, their kitchen where they, you know, have their lunches and stuff. It's huge for their shifts. just all over the place, cooking everything. Walking through the central eating, chatting, sitting area, and, you know, there were dogs there and people playing with dogs and stuff. You know, there's bikes there, there's little segways, is it? They've got motorised scooters. You know, you just take one from one place to another. There's little, you know, golf carts that you drive around to get from one place to another. It just blows me away, the amount of those transportation within Google itself. But just the nice thing, you know, having these little puppy dogs that you bring in your dog to work. They've got a sandpit there. They've got everything there. So
your first impression of Adam when you met him?
He's a nice guy. He's very friendly. He knows exactly what he's talking about. He's very clever. Before I go, I have to say thank you to Katie Watson. She was amazing, just walking me through, giving me all the time I needed, and making sure that we were all comfortable and doing what we need. But also Rob Shilkin, who is in Australia. Hi, Rob. And thank you so much for helping me out at the start there, because I was very lost. A journalist in Silicon Valley looking for help from Google, getting an Australian Googler responding. I thought it was just wicked.
All right, we'll take a break, and when we return, we'll have a listen to Lydia's interview with Adam Lesnick from Googleplex in California.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
If you were to ask anyone who uses the internet to name a search engine, or anyone who doesn't for that matter, chances are Google would be their response. 86% of Australians currently call Google home, so it's no wonder that when webmasters build and maintain websites, they do it with Google in mind. In recent times, Google has released a plethora of tools in an effort to educate and provide web designers a free and easy way to make their sites more Google and search engine friendly. Lydia Davis caught up with Adam Lesnick, Google's search engine evangelist based at Mountain View, California, to put a real voice behind those coloured letters we all know so well.
Today on Tech Talk Radio, we're visiting the Googleplex in Silicon Valley and having a chat with Adam Lesnick, Google's search evangelist. Adam's role at Google revolves around being a webmaster liaison. He spends most of his time monitoring webmaster forums and blogs. Adam's most visible role is speaking with and learning from webmasters around the world, particularly at conferences. He has just celebrated 1 year with Google. So, Adam, happy anniversary.
Welcome to
Tech Talk Radio.
Definitely a pleasure to be here.
Search engine optimization. Wow, what a buzzword in Australia at the moment.
SEO. Yeah, certainly it's quite the thing here in the States as well. It's very much combined, I would say, a part of search engine marketing, or SEM. So oftentimes people have looked at it as, how do we optimize our site for Google and for the other search engines? But I think maybe that's a little bit too narrow. The way I think is a better approach is, how do we optimize our site for users? And then from that, that typically translates into better crawling, indexing, and ranking on Google, and I would assume the other engines as well. So a lot of it has to deal with accessibility, compelling content, and oftentimes a lot of really simple tweaks that are both good for the user and good for Google.
Okay, what are they? What are the tweaks? We have to ask.
One of the ones that first comes to mind is actually the simplest, but one of the most powerful, and that's to optimize both your title tags and also your meta description tags. It's been surprising to me, actually, and sometimes scary to see even major companies having the same title and the same meta description on many, many pages. And since this typically shows up in Google search results, that doesn't tell the user very much. When they're getting ready to click, they look at it and they say, it's not very descriptive. It's not something that I want to explore. So by refining that, by having a title that mentions the company name, describes what the page or that section is about, can really help both the user and also help your site's presence in Google as well.
What should people be thinking about when they do write the meta tags?
You want to think of it as, particularly for the meta description tag, as a brief and targeted description, not a series of keywords. It can actually be a sentence or a phrase, so that it looks like something you would how you would describe your page to someone else in just a brief moment of speaking. If it looks spammy to a user, it's probably going to look spammy to us, so you want to avoid that.
Because that seems to be the common question, you know, how many keywords, what about the meta tags, what about the title, you know, and this, you know, how many keywords, I mean, what a question.
Well, we get that a lot on many different aspects of search engine optimization and site optimization overall. You know, what should be the keyword density, exactly how long should my page be, And the answer really is, use common sense. You don't want to have a keyword density, for instance, such that it just reads obnoxiously.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to have a page where you have to scroll to the point where your hand gets sore on the mouse.
Absolutely.
But similarly, having pages that are two sentences long so people have to click next, next, next. We look at it from the perspective of what would a user want to see, what is actually useful. And so we base our algorithms around that. So there really is no set number, no set ratio.
And in terms of links, that's something you haven't mentioned yet, but people do ask about all links and what should we do. If you're going to be putting something out there, you want to make sure that it reflects directly on what you are talking about.
Oh,
because
yeah.
Otherwise, what's the point? And if you do have hundreds of links, I mean, what's it going to do? So tell me about links a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, you actually, just stepping back, you touched on sort of a fun aspect that I think people don't pay enough attention to. Actually, both a fun and important aspect. They're thinking, hey, let's get as much traffic as we can. Let me get as many hits. Let me rank number one. Without always thinking about the more core subject here, what are we going to do with these folks when they come to the site? Is that page actually relevant? Okay, we've link baited this huge section of people. Congratulations. But if they hit your page and they go, yeah, this is pretty dumb, and they hit back, you've just used a lot of bandwidth. You've perhaps lost some brand or some site goodwill. So the thing to think about with links is relevance. You want to be getting links to your site that are relevant to the content you have, and you want to be linking to other pages from your site that are also relevant to what your users are probably looking for. Now, if you want to link, if you have like a personal site and you want to link to your uncle's dentistry blog and your site's not about dentistry, you know, who cares? That's great. That's fine. It's not that we're looking over every single link with a fine-tooth comb. We look at patterns, both incoming and outgoing. If it makes sense for the user, if it's not clearly spammy or obnoxious, then it's probably fine. It could definitely help the way we view and index and rank your site. People joke and they say, oh gosh, if I see another, the top 10 ways to do such and such. And, you know, it's become a bit of a cliche and a bit of a joke from that phrasing. But at the same time, I think the way we perceive link baiting is, if that content is indeed compelling, if it's relevant to what the links are coming in, then hey, more power to you. You're providing something that entertains, informs, or is useful to users, and that's great.
Well, that gets rid of my next question, which was if I'm a supplier, should I get my customers to link back to me? And you think, absolutely.
Yeah, there's one important consideration in that context. We see this all the time, for instance, with blog software or form software. It says powered by such and such on the bottom, on the footer. And, you know, that's fine. We certainly don't see that as a problem at all, as long as it's visible and not hidden. But we do want, there's one caveat there, and that the site where that's linking into shouldn't assume that if they have 80,000 links on powered by such and such to their site, they shouldn't assume that's 80,000 votes. Because that wasn't placed there typically affirmatively by that other site. So we'll see it as votes, but there is a point of diminishing returns.
Tell me about regional filters, because this is something way back when I was in Australia, 1 year ago, way back, I would use Google a lot, but we would get google.com.au. Here, that's not the case. And is there any regional filters that...
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're more subtle than a lot of people think. We're definitely not completely rearranging or including brand new content or indexing completely different content by region. Rather, we're essentially massaging what people see largely based on regional, cultural, and linguistic differences. For instance, one of the oft-noticed differences between England, Australia, and the States is the word football. So we think of something different when you say the word football. And there's also just minor linguistic changes. Like I remember when I first came to Europe and I said, excuse me, where's the restroom? And they looked at me like I was totally batty.
Yeah.
So what we try and do is we try and take that into account, those differences, and interpret what people are searching for, and then view, based upon where they are, how might they be looking for something that's different than what someone in America would be looking for. And so we may slightly re-rank some of the results or include a couple results here and there that would be different for someone in Australia than, say, in Japan or the United States.
So you do the hard work for the webmaster.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's, you know, you bring up the webmaster in this, of course, and I think some webmasters have been concerned, like, hey, I can't predict my ranking when my client is seeing something different here or from my site, the results are different in this country and that country. But we really see it as a win, not only for the user, but for the webmaster as well, because we're spreading the love. we're creating a set of results that the person in each country is more likely to click on and see as relevant. And that's better for the webmaster, it's better for the user.
Is there anything that businesses should be thinking about? In Australia, you've got to think, the other thing is we don't have the large corporations. I suppose we do have some, but not as many as you'd find, especially right here. And they don't have the money to spend on SEO and stuff like that. What are the key considerations for them?
Well, the most important thing is to speak with an authentic voice and with a language that reflects your primary audience. So if you are primarily intending to reach fellow Australians, write with a tone and with a spelling that reflects what Australians would expect to see. Spell harbour in the right way.
Yeah. Mum in the right way.
Exactly. Refer to different cultural aspects and use language that is something people would expect. If you're trying to hit multiple audiences, that becomes a little more challenging. In which case, I would pick a primary audience and spell and write for them. But then if there are specific regional differences, that, for instance, Americans need to know some tourist information that every Australian would already know, include separate pages for them. Even if some of that content is overlapping, that's fine. That's not a problem. You know, we want to discourage, of course, absolute duplicate or identical content, particularly when it's intended to deceive. And I'm sure that's not something that your listeners, or frankly the majority of webmasters, are trying to do when they take segments of content and repeat it. We don't penalize for that sort of thing. We see it as essentially an attempt to communicate with different audiences and with slightly different nuances, and that's fine.
What does blogging do for someone that has a website?
You know, when it makes sense for that site's audience, blogs can be fabulous. It's important to realize that just starting a blog for the sake of, well, it's going to improve my ranking, it's probably not going to be too effective in itself, because if you don't blog because you feel passionate about a particular subject or about your products, it's going to show, and people are going to not come back and not look at that favorably with your brand. But in the majority of cases where you do feel passionate about something, a hobby, a product, a service, blogging about that is a way to share your authentic voice. Mm-hmm. It's a way to have frequently refreshed content. And also to start a conversation, assuming you have comments turned on, to start a conversation with your visitors. And they love that typically, where they can ask you questions or give feedback and get a response directly from someone that represents that company or that organization. They're more likely to come back to see follow-ups. They're more likely to share it with their friends. So blogs inherently are best for in a user context this way.
Absolutely.
And the side benefit is that because there tends to be additional rich content, it's going to probably be beneficial for the search engines as well. The only warning on blogs is that, like any good writing and like any good site management or writing actually for sites outside of blogs, it takes time, it takes effort to write content that's interesting, compelling, funny, useful, and also to manage comments, to be able to actually not just leave those comments out there, but to participate in a conversation. So if a company is going to go down that route, it's something you want to carefully think of and make sure you have the resources and the dedication, like any aspect of your site, to really see through in a quality way.
Is there any technical differences in terms of optimizing a blog compared to optimizing a website?
There's one consideration that comes to mind, and that's that in the case of blogs, sometimes duplicate content can be an unintentional issue where you will show the exact same article at 3 or 4 or 5 different URLs. And that can both confuse Google and can also confuse your users, because when they want to bookmark a particular article and share it with their friends, if they have the chance of bookmarking or linking to one of 3 or 4 different links, well, when you refine your blog, some of those links may go bad after a time. And it also can diffuse the page rank and other signals that enable us to see which pages are most relevant and important. And we see that most frequently in blog and also content management systems on the whole. So it is important to make sure that you have one URL, and this applies for all sites, one URL for each page of content.
Webmaster Central. How much can you tell me before you have to kill me?
No, it's the opposite, actually. I would talk about Webmaster Central until you kick me out of the room here, because it's one of the things that I think we're really most proud of and excited about here. It is the way we see that we can manage scalable communications. And the keyword here is scalable because, you know, there are a ton of us here in search quality and on the Webmaster Tools team. But compared to the number of webmasters around the world, I mean, my goodness, that's a scary ratio. So even though we've been building out these teams rapidly, even just since I've been here, Webmaster Tools is a way that we can share information, for instance, through the blog that's in Webmaster Central, through the help documents, which I think we have those now in 18 languages, I think.
Wow, that's impressive, isn't it?
And we're building out the blog. Actually, stay tuned pretty soon in some new languages for the Webmaster blog as well.
That's great.
We have the Webmaster group where there are discussions. But of equal importance, we have all the tools where people can see, how does Googlebot see my site?
Yes.
There are ways that you can test your robots.txt file to say, wait a minute, am I accidentally blocking out entire sections? So from information, from a way that you can tell Google things to help Google better crawl your site, and for ways for you to interact with the webmasters, I think it's just been I'm biased, but I think it's been an outstanding resource so far. And it's also a multinational team, so I have a lot of faith that you'll continue to see some really good stuff out of that.
A lot of people hesitate to join community groups like that because they think, I don't really have anything valid to say that's interesting. They don't. They should be, shouldn't they?
Yeah.
You should encourage
them. And because even if you are not a geek or a great techie type person, you can offer insights into other people's sites. Such as that, well, you know what? When I was trying to order something on your site or I was trying to look at some of the full-scale pictures, I couldn't figure out how to do it. And then, you know, sometimes a site owner will be like, well, why, didn't you see this link here? And they're like, no, that's like way at the bottom of the page. And people are able to help each other literally optimize sites, not technically, but from a navigation or from a user perspective, or they'll say, you know, that just looks too markety. Maybe you could make it so it just explains your product better. And that, I think, more than any search engine optimization technical stuff, that is the key to really doing well in the search engines, to have your sites be clean and more navigable. And these groups, I think, have offered a lot of good insights in that area.
Robots text, you mentioned. How relevant is that to SEO?
Yeah, it can really be a great help in two different areas. Well, I should actually take a brief step back for those who aren't familiar with robots.txt file. It's just a tiny little text file that anyone can typically write and post in the root of your website, so right at the top level. And that particular file is what the different bots from the search engines, including Googlebot, look at to determine what can we crawl on your site and what are we not allowed to crawl. So, for instance, you might not want to have us crawl your client discussion area because, you know, that might be, you might be comfortable having that open on the web, but you don't really want it indexed. Or you might have an area of your site that's under construction, and you don't want that indexed yet either. So you would then put a statement that's disallowed, and then such and such directory. And then when our Googlebot comes, it sees that and says, oh, not going to go there. And that also helps you in Google, because if there are pages that are empty, for instance, you have restaurant reviews on your site, and a whole bunch of restaurants don't have reviews yet, you probably don't want to have those show up in our index because it's just going to annoy people that click on, the Aqua Dining reviews. I'm sure by now that's got to have reviews in Sydney. But, you know, it's a fine restaurant I ate at. But,
absolutely.
You know, pretend it didn't. And people typed in Aqua Dining reviews. And they get there and then it says, be the first to offer a review. And they're like, I don't like this site. This is useless. Yep. So it helps your site. It helps Google to make sure that the content that we're putting in our site, in our engine, is the content you want to have there.
Sitemaps. You guys, you, MSN, Yahoo, got together, made sitemaps.org. What is it? What does it do?
Oh, that can be a really useful component, thing to do on your site. It's actually a file that you place on your site, and you can use automatic generators to do your work for you, that tells all of these different search engines what all your pages are on your site that you'd like to have indexed. And it optionally mentions what priority certain sections or pages are for your site. Like, well, these ones, if you're going to crawl just this many pages, make sure you tackle these. These are the most important ones. Or we actually update these ones because it's news every week. And then these ones once a year. And so you putting the sitemap gives the crawler hints so it can better crawl and index individual sites. And the great thing is that this is an augment to the normal crawling cycle. So it can't hurt your sight. It can only serve to bolster what we're able to see. So another brief example, if you have a site that has a very big database and all the pages might not be interlinked, and so it'd be normally hard for the crawler to find, by doing a sitemap, we can then see every one of those real estate listings or restaurant reviews or product information pages. It doesn't mean we'll index all of it, but it just helps us better understand what's on your site.
What about small companies that have, you know, between 100 and 1,000 pages? Is that something they should be doing?
I still think it's valuable to look at, primarily because, and I even did a sitemap for one of my own sites, just a fun hobby site, it took me less than an hour. I think it actually probably half hour to figure out, okay, how do I make this? Where do I put it? And once you do it, you can use these automatic generators to update it. So while it's not a total set it and forget it, it's one of those things that once you do it, it really is not a significant investment in either time and certainly doesn't cost you anything.
That's the other part of SEO, I suppose, isn't it? It's a consistent, you know, continual doing things to your site and making sure that things are updated and it's not you do it once and then forget about it.
Yeah, absolutely, especially because sometimes links go stale, for instance.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's nothing more embarrassing than as a company saying one of our most privileged partners is so-and-so and then forgetting that they moved their site to a new domain. And so when your potential customers click on that, they get a 404 or a site not found.
Yeah.
So maintaining and always being vigilant about the content you have on your site and also making sure you know what people are saying about saying about your site. Staying atop of that conversation and keeping a clean and consistently effective site, that takes time. It takes effort and it's worth it.
PageRank, that one gets me. I really don't get it.
That's one of the things that webmasters really tend to focus on. And part of it is because there's that little green bar in our toolbar that always is there saying, you have this much PageRank.
Yep.
And I really want, one of the key things that I'd like to emphasize is that people really do tend to, I think, worry too much about PageRank. When it first was unveiled, when it was first was actually invented by Larry Page, hence the name, it was actually somewhat revolutionary in that even though it might seem common sense now to use links into a site to determine relevance and importance, back then it really wasn't being done.
Oh,
well, nowadays, the basic tenets of PageRank, which is that how and what other sites link to you as, plays a role in how the search engines see the importance and relevance of your pages. Right now, it's just one of well over 100, maybe even I think as many as 200 factors that we take into account at the crawling and indexing stage. So by people spending so much time saying, oh, it increased one, it decreased a bit, or even worse, my competitor has this page rank. How come they're ranked in that way? And I think it ends up not being time and resources well spent because it's really more of a symptom rather than an indicator of pure quality or what will happen. It's much better to try and look at your site holistically. What kind of traffic are you getting from search engines? And even more important than that, how is that traffic converting? If people are simply going to your site from Google, clicking on one page and then going somewhere else, well, PageRank isn't going to help you at all.
Now, the number of words to searching, like a search query, I remember when I used to, you'd sit there for ages trying to work out what's the right word, you know, years ago.
Wouldn't
be going, okay, which word, what would best reflect what I want? Now you can put in, I really don't know how many words into, I should have tested it. Do you know how many you can put in now?
You know, that's a great question. I have to say, I'm not really certain on that. I know it's gotten longer over time, so that people we see frequently, and I do this, you type in a big phrase from lyrics that you heard on the radio, and you're like, what is that song?
And
it used to be there was a much shorter limit, and now I think for all practical purposes, you can type in pretty long phrases.
How many words are people searching on now, do you think?
You know, I think it actually has slightly increased over time, and that's my understanding. With that said, our ability to understand what people are trying to get at has dramatically improved over the years.
Yes.
The key tenet here, and this comes down from the very top, from Marissa and from Larry and Sergey and all the folks in search quality, is we shouldn't try and change the way people search. We should change the way that we're able to interpret what people mean. And so over time, we've gotten better with that, both by having really large data sets to see what people search on, what they click on. Mm-hmm. And we've also been easing in bits of personalization so that when we see what you tend to type in and what you tend to then go to, that gives us a better understanding of what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to type in really very detailed queries, but can just type in just a few words. Of course, you can always refine that later.
Quality of words. That was one thing that intrigued me. Not so much keywords, where you have to have these specific words, but how important is having, you know, a decent style?
You know, for your users, I think it's really critical that at least you have a style. Mm. To be able to have a unique voice, ideally one that is, given the context, of course, that's professional and appropriate for that audience. So if you're writing on behalf of a Fortune 500 company and you're trying to attract, you know, large blue-chip consulting contracts, you want to write in a way that your grammar is correct, your spelling is accurate for your location, and so on. But on the whole, Google cares less about the exact tone or even the perfect spelling and grammar of a site and cares more about that the content is rich, compelling, and unique. So if you're mostly just grabbing snippets from other places, we can tell that, and we will think, well, you know, that in itself is not really a valuable destination. But if you're writing regularly and you're writing with content that users find compelling, however the tone might be, then the specific word choice itself is significantly less critical. I call these things, frankly, the smell test in a way. You know, I look at that and I'm like, that kind of smells fishy, or, yeah, that's totally what I expect to see from this type of company, or when I type in this word, that's the sort of content I hope and want, you know, expected to see.
One of the other things that I've noticed and really annoys me, sadly, is jargon. There's all this jargon, you know. I can't even pronounce half of them. You know, search arbitrage, long tail, canonicalization. I can't even pronounce that. You know, it's what are these things, and why do we have them? Because suddenly all these people are busy trying to work out what these new words mean. Are they important?
Oh yeah, my
goodness. Does Google care about these words?
If it's any consolation, hanging out with my med school friends is significantly worse.
Oh, okay.
Every industry has its jargon, right?
Yes.
And I would hope in most cases this type of specialized vocabulary has come into place to, you know, save extra words. Sometimes it's just because people want to sound important or want to sell high-priced contracts. Hopefully not the majority. Some of these concepts and words are indeed important. Like one of the ones that we have actually used and we've heard a lot is canonicalization.
There you go.
It took me a while to pronounce that, in fact. But what that actually looks at is, for any given page, for instance, there might be more than one way to refer to it. So a site might be at www.whatever-site.com.au, or it could be without the www.
Yes.
And that's historically because the way servers were made, there could actually be different sites, different content on the dub versus the non-dub. Mm-hmm. It sounds crazy nowadays, but it's true. Yeah. So we had to train the bot to view those as different sites. Mm-hmm. The problem is nowadays when their sites respond to both, it can actually confuse both the users and confuse the Google bot. But the concepts, even though they might be jargony, tend to still be pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
So I think as sort of a key suggestion here is that people shouldn't feel daunted and overwhelmed by this vocabulary. They should feel free and completely unembarrassed, either on our forum or any forum for that matter, to say, hey, you know, I'm new. I want to build a great site. Can you tell me, help me out? What does this mean? And also, one other quick tip is that one of the sort of lesser known things on our search engine is you can type in the word define, colon, and then in quotes, put a phrase or a word. And that will very often give you plain English interpretations or definitions of
what that is. I use that all the time.
Oh, great, you already knew. Wow, you're ahead of the curve on that.
No, the operators that you have, I think, are brilliant. That's just that people don't know that they exist half the time, which is bizarre.
You know, it's an interesting tension for us because on one hand, coming back to the same thing we were discussing, that we want to make searching so intuitive for the user that they don't have to change or adapt the way they search. But on the flip side, we know there are a ton of power users that want to be able to really drill down and specify, you know, in URL colon.
Yes.
Or, well, actually, here's one for your listeners that I think is super useful and not terribly difficult. Site colon.
Yeah.
So when you know that, for instance, on a particular American university site, Princeton.edu, mm-hmm. there was this great article you read. You could type in then site:Princeton.edu, and then the name of the article or word from the article, and that will only show you pages on that site. We can do a better job of explaining, you know, how we work and what we do. And I think over time we have been doing a better job with this, but, you know, there's still room for improvement.
How often does Google index?
The answer isn't as straightforward as you'd probably like. We are indexing much more rapidly now than we did before. However, it also depends on the site. So when we see, for instance, a really prominent news site, or even a blog that tends to refresh its content and add new good content regularly, as we see that, we adjust the crawling rate for that particular site. So we will crawl it more often, and then also tend to index those pages more often. So there's really no set time. It depends on what we see, and how often that particular site is updating. One brief note on the same topic. We recently added a pretty neat tool in the Webmaster Central, where you can tell us actually to crawl us either slower, or in some instances, if we've been holding back, you can tell us to crawl faster or crawl more. And over time, we'll be giving more and more of this control and offering the opportunity for webmasters to tell us how they want us to crawl their site. But we've gotten a bunch of feedback like, help, you're pummeling my server, and I haven't ramped it up yet, or, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting because I saw that, and I was thinking, why would anyone want you to index less frequently?
Yeah, sometimes when, like, for instance, when I was in grad school, yeah. I ran a web server on my stupid little computer.
Oh.
That could only handle, like, a few queries at a time. It was just for fun. It was, like, for my friends.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the time, some search engines were discovering it, and they could also be pummeling it really hard, going through, okay. you know, a lot of pages very quickly. And then my friends couldn't view the pages. Now, that's an extreme example.
Yes.
But if you're even a larger site with a real, honest server, and you have a ton of pages, you may not want to have, for whatever reasons, bandwidth concerns, etc., you may not want to have us hit it as hard. Now, with that said, I think we've done really a stellar job at naturally not crawling too quickly. But, you know, we, just in case, we want to give webmasters that opportunity to say, hey, hold back for a bit.
And, of course, the final question, how many servers does Google have?
Oh, wow, that's fun. Yeah, I don't know how many of your listeners are fans of Douglas Adams.
One, yeah.
One? Oh, we have one. So I do have to admit, it is one of my favorite answers that I have given before, but it still remains compelling. And the answer is 42.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you so much for talking with Tech Talk
Radio
today.
Definitely a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link.
You're listening.
Dr. Ron?
Here I am.
Residual powers. And I've got some residual powers.
You can't turn off CDMA.
In terms of the volume,
I understand
to give fingerprints. Now, this
we may have digressed.
Talk radio.
Bill Burgess also claimed the country would remain behind.
We used to think 600 kilos.
Don't open things that are good that you're not expecting, even if they do a thing.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
With the price of copper on the increase, thieves are again stealing cables and overhead power lines, hitting railways, electrical substations and other infrastructure. An incident on the 5th of November in Melbourne left early morning commuters stranded after thieves removed copper cabling used to control the signals and boom gates at an eastern suburbs railway crossing. A Connex spokeswoman, Kate de Klerk, said that copper theft had been on the increase this year.
We've had over 20 incidents of copper theft since the start of September. It's resulted in more than 500 trains being delayed, and more than 15 trains cancelled. It's a huge inconvenience to customers, and it's very frustrating for us.
Here's Detective Senior Sergeant Brian Clark, officer in charge of the Victoria Police Transit Criminal Investigation Unit.
In recent times, there's been an increase in copper wire thefts on the system, on and off the system, I believe. Well, what we believe is happening is that they're stealing the copper wire and they're selling it at various scrap metal dealers.
But the problem is not just limited to Melbourne or indeed Australia. Early this year in March, the state Senate in Oklahoma approved a measure intended to curb the growing problem of copper theft. A new bill has introduced additional regulations for second-hand dealers to make it easier for law enforcement authorities to track down copper thieves. Senator Cliff Brannan said action was required to curb a dramatically increasing problem throughout the state of Oklahoma.
We're asking some of the junk dealers to do a tag and hold where they would need to hold the particular metal that's being pawned for a 15-day period of time, and to also ask the person selling the copper to show some sort of proof of identification and how they came into possession of the copper.
Senator Brannan said the bill would also increase penalties for junk dealers who failed to adhere to state regulations on copper theft. The fine for a first offence would increase from $50 to $500, and the second offence would result in a $2,500 fine. Subsequent offences could even result in the junk dealer's licence being revoked. But copper theft is nothing new. The Postmaster General's Department, as Telstra was known in the 1950s, was forced to devise its own ways to detect copper theft and to report offenders to police. Former PMG Technical Officer Graham Gall spoke to Tech Talk Radio and explained how copper theft was managed in Australia 50 years ago.
Copper theft of wire, Ron, is not new at all. While I was in the Long Line branch of the Country Division in the city, most of the telephone trunking was via cable, but the shorter trunking routes, particularly along the railway lines, were all open aerial. There was no such thing in those days as coaxial cable, and quite often we would lose circuits, particularly around Gisborne and Woodend and Macedon. They would just automatically, or for no reason at all, just go down. And we technicians in City West Exchange devised some DC circuits to put over these copper wires to ensure that their continuity was maintained. I remember being on duty one night at 10 p.m. and three alarms went off, and we found that they were on the main trunk route going to Bendigo. Now, Bendigo was one of the main trunk routes through to Sydney, and they were aerial wires, not cable. The alarms went off, we did some tests, we had what we called radar on wire, and we rang the police. And the police found the would-be thieves, or the alleged thieves, along the railway embankment, merrily cutting down the copper wires, rolling it up and taking it home.
So copper theft is nothing new and does in fact appear to be on the rise. And apart from the short-term inconvenience of cancelled train services and power blackouts, taxpayers are also affected by rising insurance premiums, power bills, and even the cost of new homes, as cables are frequently stolen from building construction sites. The Energy Networks Association is a national body representing gas and electricity distribution companies throughout Australia. They're very concerned about copper theft, and in particular, theft of copper cable, copper straps, and copper bus bars. Andrew Blythe from the ENA explains that when it comes to copper theft, consumers are the ultimate losers.
This activity is dangerous, it's stupid, and it must stop. It's something that Australian consumers may have to actually bear in mind in the future, that this may flow through to their electricity bills. And we would actually be calling for a national action plan to be developed to address this major issue.
Thank you. So apart from good old-fashioned police work, what's being done to tackle the problem in Australia? One company is distributing a data dot technology similar to that used on some new motor vehicles. The New South Wales company, Data Dot Commercial, is the primary distributor of a new technology known as Data Dot DNA. This entails thousands of tiny microchips encoded with a company's name and identification number being sprayed over a length of copper cable. Data dots are not visible to the naked eye and can only be seen under ultraviolet light. Despite the inherent dangers of serious injury and even electrocution, rail operators, utilities companies and police still find themselves battling with thieves who are simply chasing a quick dollar, oblivious to the impact that their actions are having on the community. Hopefully, the emergence of new legislation, combined with security technology, will start to decrease the incidence of copper theft. If you notice suspicious activity near a railway line or a construction site or an electrical substation, contact your local law enforcement authority straight away. In Australia, ring 000 for urgent police attendance.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio's Summer Series, and we'll be back next week when Dr. Ron Smith presents more of the best of the last 3 years of the show. Visit the Tech Talk Radio website for all the information on past shows and feel free to send us an email and say hello. And don't forget the Tech Talk Radio forum at forum.techtalkradio.com.au. Here you can share your thoughts and dilemmas with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners. So that's Tech Talk Radio for this week. Until next week, behave yourselves over the festive break, stay safe, and be sure to tune in to the station you're listening to right now in 2008 for your weekly fix of tech news, gadgets, politics, scuttlebutt rumours and facts in the technological world. I'm Andrew McComb, and on behalf of everyone here at Tech Talk Radio, see you next week and thanks for listening. Tech Talk Radio is brought to you each and every week by a band of dedicated professionals from within the broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer and host Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron, panellists Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion from Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications, and podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night from 8 p.m. The crew wish to thank all the stations that take the show, including 3WBC, 3XX, Cairns FM, Highlands FM and Queer FM in Western Australia. Tech Talk Radio is available for syndication on your local station. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit the website techtalkradio.com.au for more information. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.